Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Book Discussion with guess who? Fran Lewis. And guess what? It's snowing again. And if anybody has any pull with the snow people up there and can make it go away and bring out the sunshine, this girl would really be very appreciative because it's going to snow for the rest of the week and on the weekend. And how rude is that? But we're going to heat things up and liven it up with the author of Eyes of Emerald, which is about a young woman becoming the first of her generation to graduate from high school in the new land. The time was 1930, the place New York City, and these were not the best of economic times, but everyone has dreams and everybody wants a good life. So we're going to talk to the author of Eyes of Emerald, Harvey Stellman. Harvey, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, and welcome. Well, I can't welcome you. I'll just say thank you.
You're welcome. I can welcome myself back here. So this was an interesting prologue that you wrote, and you wrote this book for your father, right?
I wrote it in his memory because it's one of the greatest stories I've ever heard, and he told it to me a few different times. I always sat and listened. It's only a 3 to 5 minute story, but I told it to my best friend and son, and he said, I would love to help you write it. And we're off and running. So that's how I got into it. And I always wanted to write, I thought somebody should write something, book or a movie, and I never thought it would be me.
Well, you know what? That's great because I never thought I would write my mom's story, and it's going to be published at the end of the month.
Great.
She had Alzheimer's, so you know what? Family stories and true stories are really better to me to review and to read sometimes than these fictional stories that they write about the same type of character.
So when creating
this novel, why did you decide to share this particular story about Esther Rothstein and explain her relationship to you and your family?
Okay, first of all, I have to tell you, all names are fictional. Okay, my father told me the story about a cousin of ours that was older than he was. That comes into play later on. Was left out of something, but for first names, my partner and I chose first names of people we knew that would relate back to the 1930s, like the main character, Esther, is actually my mother's first name.
Oh, I see what you did.
And Rothstein is just a name, I'm picked out of somewhere. I don't even know, probably my head, because I haven't found that yet. That's how we got started with it. And I've already lost what the question was.
Well, how did you, when you changed the name, what made you change the name of the character? What made you change it?
I didn't really change the name. I never knew any of the names of any of the people. My father just told me the story about a cousin of ours. And he just, would say, I've got a story that you've got to hear. Even if it was the third or fourth time he told me, it didn't matter. My father was a storyteller, and I've heard many stories from him. And this one, he says, this is special because this is about a cousin of ours that you'll never meet. And he took me back to the Great Depression, and I immediately knew why I wouldn't meet her. I thought she was that much older than him, but it wasn't that many years, but she probably has passed away by now because my father did a while back.
Well, it was interesting because back then a lot of kids did not graduate high school and didn't have the chance, even at a higher education. And I know that my mom, my grandmother got very sick, and I know my mom had to quit, you know, stop high school, but she did graduate. And I know that she had to stop to take care of her. So it was a big deal when somebody graduated high school. So why was Esther's family so excited about the fact that she graduated? And what did they hope for her in the future?
Well, in their life, they were immigrants coming over from Minsk, okay? And they came here. And whereas in their country, not everybody went to high school or the equivalent of, and especially Jewish people were kept out of many of the schools. And of course, they were Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
When they got to this country, they wanted so badly for their children to be educated, and Esther was the oldest, actually, of their two children, and her brother's three children,
mm-hmm.
and they all lived in the same building with their grandmother, so everybody was there, and all they wanted was for the kids to get a good education and to be able to grow up good Americans and to be able to advance in the society.
Well, that would be what most parents would want. So why did you decide to tell the story and place the narrator who's telling the story in a library? I thought that was kind of unique.
Well, I would have to say it was when I started writing it, it's hard for me to explain. This was the first attempt I ever had at writing a book. I remember my teachers used to tell me, "Oh, you'll never be able to write." And, I never understood, because I found out a quick off-side thing is I used to do something in high school, which is probably why I didn't do that great in school,
mm-hmm.
when, you know, teachers give you a book report and
mm-hmm.
they say a lot of times, pick out a book and write a story and read it and then write what you think of the whole thing. So I was kind of the lazy type at school. I would rather be out playing basketball or football.
Mm-hmm.
So I would sit down, I'd make up a book, I'd make up a title, make up an author, make up a bibliography. I'd write the story, and here was, they said I couldn't write. And I'd write this story, and like every teacher has read every book. Well, that can't be true. Well, I'd write this story, and the teacher would write something like a C-, okay? And then they would write in red under it. I don't think you understood what the teacher was, what the author was trying to say. And I wanted to tell them, "You idiot, I am the author." But, of course, I would get a lower grade if I did that. So,
and they never, ever, ever went online or went to a bookstore or anything to find out. I taught reading and writing. I was a reading and writing staff developer. And
uh-huh.
I work with kids in sixth grade and whatever, and every grade, except kindergarten. I loved working with older children. I would know if they fudged it. And I would know if it was an author that I never heard of, and it's possible, I probably would have gone to the library or called the library to find out how many other books this author wrote and if this author actually wrote this title. So that's kind of like remiss. And how could you say that you didn't understand what the author was saying when there was no author. You were the author. That's pretty sad.
That's what made me think that teachers weren't as intelligent as they thought they were. I mean, back in those days, we didn't have computers.
Yeah, I know.
But if we did have computers and they checked the author out, and if they would have checked my name, they would find that, as far as I've been able to tell, I am the only Harvey Stelman in the world. Because I've Googled every continent, and, you know, especially the United States, and I can't find another Harvey Stelman with one L. So, I mean, they would have found me out if they had computers with no problem.
Well, what did you do with those stories? Did you keep them?
No, unfortunately, I
got rid of... You should have. You could. That would make a great book.
Well, actually, the stories were pretty good, if I do say so myself, because it even got the teacher to read the thing, and they would leave marks in it, of course, as what they thought of different parts. So I know they've read it, and they never said anything was wrong with the story. But they had problems with me not understanding the author. And I even did that in college once, in an English class. And, I might have gotten a B on it, but, you know, I asked the teacher if he's ever read the book, and the teacher with an honest face and said, "Yes, I have. I thought it was a good read." And I just naturally kept it to myself and said, "You idiot. You know, this is what they call a professor." And
well, a lot of them. I know. I took my reading master's, my second master's, and the reading professor gave a midterm, and I forget nothing. And I'm answering the questions, and I'm saying, she wants to know the answer, the definition of a specific word, and for testing kids in reading. And I'm saying, I have the word 6 times in my book, and I know the definition is wrong. I know the definition is wrong. And I put it down the right way, and I put it down the wrong way. When I get my paper back, I get like 92 out of 100, which to me is unacceptable for other reasons. Mm-hmm. And she says, it was a B+, and I hit the roof. So I went through the paper, added up the points, and I said to her, I think you need a calculator because it's really 96. And then I said to her, this definition, look in my book, in 6 different ways, you gave the definition of this particular word, and it's wrong. And she had to give me a 99 or something like that. I got 1 point off. And, of course, my mother said, what did you do wrong? Because 100 was her only grade. If I didn't get 100 on a test, I'd write it over. So I put in the answer. I said, Mom, are you happy? I mean, it was hilarious. But I wound up having to go to the head of the reading department and saying, there are so many discrepancies and so many things on this test. I said, I don't know. Yeah, I don't want to get her in trouble, but... Meanwhile, they let her go at the end of the year because we were smarter than her. And we knew our stuff, and she really didn't, and it was really sad. But let's go on to who was Rebecca, and where did the girls decide to work?
Okay, Rebecca was Esther's best friend. She was a year older than Esther, and she already had a position with a textile company named Finkelbaum's, and she evidently talked to the head secretary there, to the boss, and they found there was one position available because they were, lower ranking secretaries because they did filing, and if you needed a cup of coffee, they would get it for you, just like it was in anything you hear about the old days. You know, they were totally subservient to the men that worked there, and that's just the way life was at that time. So she is her best friend. She got her a job, and the book gets really interesting when Rebecca invites Esther to go to lunch with her on Tuesday, which is her day to go to this one restaurant. And after going to that restaurant, Esther's life changed completely after meeting the owner of the restaurant.
Well, the other thing that changed was that she never ate anything that wasn't kosher before. Now, for those of you that have never eaten Chinese food, I can't eat it anymore because whatever reason, and I love it. So if they steam it for me, it's delicious, it's fine. But for those of you that haven't had Chinese food, you don't know what you're missing. It's so good.
My wife has the same thing. Whenever we get Chinese food, she always says, I'd like some steamed vegetables. And because my wife has a degree in master's in clinical nutrition, and then she also has Crohn's disease, where she's not allowed to eat certain things, and she's just definitely, let's say, 5'4 and 100 pounds, if she's wet.
Welcome to my world.
You know, we'd get along well.
Yeah, I'm only 5 feet, but yeah, about that about 108 pounds from 190. So yeah,
okay.
We get along. We could go out to dinner together, she and I, because no one would I get criticized when I say I wanted steamed chow mein or steamed mushu chicken or something like that, and they look at me, well, why don't you have it this way? I go, why don't you mind your own business? It's okay. So she gets his attention right away. And she tries to not really get his attention, but she becomes involved with him. And how come she has to hide it? Because she can't tell her family.
In the 1930s, if you dated someone who was another race, alone on another
religion.
There's no way your parents would want to hear about it.
Yes, welcome to my world. You got it.
Okay, for the most part, except as I can tell you, in latter years, my first cousin, my father's niece, who was like a daughter to him, Jewish girl, she ended up marrying an Italian guy, and his mother just happened to be Al Capone's goddaughter. But
oh,
I didn't find that out until I was in my 30s or more. She was already passed.
That must have been interesting.
Oh, yeah. I've met some very interesting people in my life. I almost got shot for wanting to shake hands with a guy because nobody touched that particular Don.
That would have been fun,
and his
too.
And boys were behind them with pistols, and their hands were inside their jackets. My friend didn't yell, Daddy's my friend, I would probably not be here.
Well, I know my dad had some interesting friends, too. My father was a dry cleaner, and if I needed something figured out or something was wrong, all I had to do was say, Dad, this is the problem, and I never asked how he fixed it. Nor did I want to know how he fixed it. He had his own way of doing things. He and my uncle. My uncle was the head of UJA. So all you had to do was say my uncle's name anywhere to anyone, and that was the end of it. It got done. I go, I could deal with that. I wish they were here now. So when it became apparent that Sammy cared for Esther, he did something that was really over the top. What did he do, and how come he did that? That was so sneaky.
Well, that's something I would really like the reader to find out for themselves.
Okay, so we won't tell them that. We won't tell them that, but he really cared about her a lot.
He fell in love with her. She was a beauty queen, and from the moment he saw her, he had feelings for her right away. where previously he had the same thing happen in England, and because he started seeing the head schoolmaster's daughter, he was kicked out of the school because, of course, once again, it was a racist thing. You're not my culture, you're not my religion, and goodbye. So that's how he got to the States. He wanted another new beginning after the first one.
Well, I thought there were two characters, so we won't get into Sammy too much yet. But there were two characters that I thought were hilarious. One was Doris, the matchmaker.
Okay.
Oh, that was hilarious because that would be something that one of my relatives would do. Actually, they did. It didn't work too well. And Jaime Horowitz, who reminded me of somebody I went out with that definitely wouldn't work with me. And I have to give Esther credit because I thought she really handled herself very well. So who were these two people, and why would she introduce her to Iv?
Well,
it's horrible.
First of all, Doris worked at Finkelbaum's, and she was the head secretary to the owner of the company, whose name was, I believe, Finkelbaum.
Mm.
And Esther wasn't seeing anybody at the time, and in getting wind of it right away, Doris had to do something because she was, the Jewish word would be a yenta, which is a matchmaker. And she believed it was her job to find the man for Esther. And there are good matchmakers and there are bad matchmakers. And I don't know how her other matches went, but from this one, I can say it was pretty bad.
Well, it was pretty awful, and Esther pretty much handled it because he was anything but a gentleman. He was rude. Even when they went out to dinner, he was rude. So tell everybody a little bit about what we could share about Sammy, his background and his family.
Well, Sammy came from the upper class. His father was the guy I made him. Now, you got to understand, my father told me this story. It was a 3 to 5 minute story.
Mm-hmm.
And in making it a book, we wanted to get it to be over 200 pages.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to do a lot of embellishing.
Mm-hmm.
And the outline for the story as to what happens next,
mm-hmm.
But I made up, well, my partner and I made up what the insides or the guts of the story would be about. And here I am again. I'm a little older than you. I'm forgetting what the question was.
Well, writing a book is like the most amazing thing. And the minute you see your name on the cover and it published, I know the first time I saw my first title published, I cried. I was like, I wrote that. And I wrote it about my sister and I growing up in the South Bronx. And I said, it may not be a bestseller, but to me, it was like the greatest accomplishment in the world because I wrote little stories about my sister and I growing up in the South Bronx. And I think the most exciting part, like your father told you the story, was that my sister edited the book. And
exactly. The one that edited the book, I had a few different editors.
Yeah.
And the one that finally finished it turned out to be, as I grew up in the South Bronx also, he lived on the floor. He and his twin brother lived on the floor below me. And when I moved in there at 5 years old, it was like the three of us were always together. So when his twin passed away, I went from Chicago to San Diego for the funeral.
Mm.
And their mother had me ride with the family. And, you know, she she told everyone at the service, yeah, this is his, the funny thing was he had an older brother named Harvey, and she said, this is his other brother, Harvey. So that was really strange, the way some people did a double take.
Well, how did both families feel about both people?
Like I said before, in those days, things were different. In particular, if you brought somebody home that was another religion, that was definitely a big strike. And if they were also another race, that was a huge strike. That's something that would almost not happen. And especially if you're in the South. But none of the parents immediately took to the other, the boy or the girl, because there was no way they were used to this. The way it went was mother and father expected the daughter to grow up. She's a nice Jewish girl. She would marry a nice Jewish boy. She would have children, keep house, and be a good wife. And in Sammy's place, it would be, well, he's a good Chinese man of high aristocratic family background. He would bring home a girl that would fit exactly the type of lifestyle that he had, and they would get married, and maybe if Sammy was lucky enough, he would become the governor of the province in which his father was.
Well, Sammy had a bodyguard named Louis. So what was his relationship to Sammy, and why was he so loyal?
Well, they were basically the same age. And Louis's parents, as their parents and their parents before them, were in service to the Chang family dynasty. And it was just a natural thing that Louis was going to be in service to Sammy, although Sammy never took it that way. He just looked at him as his best friend. But Louis had vowed, took a vow to his parents that he would always be with Sammy wherever he went in the world, and he would always be there to protect him, especially being one who was very proficient in martial arts.
So you want somebody like that. So how did Louis and Rebecca get together?
Well, they met at a trip to the zoo. Sammy was asking Esther out, and she would say no. And then finally he came up with, why don't my friend over there, he owned a restaurant, and he pointed to his friend, and he said, why don't he and I meet you and your best friend at the Bronx Zoo? And that way it wouldn't be a date. You would go there and go home. We wouldn't be taking you. It would be just like we bumped into each other.
And yeah, but then something happens when they go there.
When they go there, gangs weren't big in those days, but a couple of ruffians were big enough. And I shouldn't say gangs weren't big in those days. That's when Capone was at his height. So, and Arnie, I'm trying to think of the Meyer Lansky and Bugsy Siegel were around. So I shouldn't say that. But at the same time, a couple of thugs approached them in the park. I think there were three of them. And Louis just asked Sammy to please step back because he wouldn't stop insulting Sammy, when Sammy was trying to bring the situation into a discussion and end it there so there wouldn't be a fight and they wouldn't have that. So Louis just said, let me take care of the situation. And Louis stepped in front of Sammy and he said, I would be happy to take you three gentlemen on if you would like that, one at a time or three against one. And they basically laughed at him. And when they were lying on the floor to this martial arts expert, which they didn't know anything about back in the 30s, they found out they better not mess with Louis. And at the same time, they ended up running away. And Rebecca really looked up to Sammy for doing what he did. And they got closer and friendly, very friendly during that time at the zoo.
Well, the Bronx Zoo is my favorite place to go. I love the Bronx Zoo.
Oh, I can't disagree with you.
I love it.
I still remember riding a camel.
Yeah, actually, that's funny that you should say that because my little nephew made me do that. And I wanted to scream because it was at that time that I weighed about 170, not anymore. And he said, would you like to come and ride a camel with me? And did you ever see this big, huge person? And the guy pushed my butt right up on the camel. And I never really quite sat on it kind of right. I have a picture of it somewhere. And all the kids are up there happy riding this camel. And poor Fran's on his butt. Seriously, in the back. And then he says to me, do you want to do it again? And I said, you're lucky that I did it once. No less twice? Right. You got to be kidding me. It was so embarrassing because I'm sitting there and my better end was like sticking out. I said, but you have to do it once. If you
definitely
don't do it once, what's the point? The children's zoo was great.
You may never have made the camel happy either.
No, the camel
that.
Gave me a dirty look. I thought he was going to kick me with his hump or something. And he had like nine of them instead of two or three, whatever. So that was not, you know, that was not right. But the camel ran away and he's still not talking to me anymore either. So which events in this story, which places were real, really happened?
What really happened? Well, Esther did graduate from high school. Esther did meet Sammy at a restaurant. He did get a job and did meet him at the restaurant. Let's see. Something happened and they did end up in China. And from there, you know, I know the family didn't particularly care for her, but at the same time, I was lucky my friend, friend's son, was a history major in college, and he threw in what was happening at that time period in China. And the two of us went on the computer and we got all the different Chinese traditions, you know. So we were able to put together, you know, something pretty simply because we wrote this, the whole book, in, I'd say, a year. But when I say a year, he was doing a master's. And so we only got together on Sunday afternoons for about 2 hours and ended up coming up with 258 pages. And then after that, in the next year and a half or so, by myself, I wrote 10 movies, and it may have been 2 years, and I actually wrote a sequel to the book. Which
that
is
was
totally...
one of my questions that I was going to ask, because the ending leaves you wondering what's next, but we won't say for who. But it leaves you wondering, like, what is happening next? And the ending was a tearjerker, people. Seriously, a tearjerker. You know, you don't expect that. And I'm not going to say what happened or what caused it or why, but it was sad. That's all I will say.
And everybody always says to me, why did you end the story like that? And I said, because that's the way the story ended. And
that's so sad,
I couldn't change it around. You know, I had to be loyal to my father and write it the way he said it was. I didn't want to change anything because I wanted to honor the man that I've always honored more than anyone.
So when you wrote the sequel, there was more to the story that he told you?
No.
No.
Absolutely
not. So when you write
not.
The sequel, you're gonna write it your way, or what you think should happen to her, or anybody else?
It's written, and my friend from back in the Bronx is also editing this, and I must say that we've been friends for over 60 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And he's retired from working as an editor for Medicaid on the West Coast, and he just
I'm
said,
down
hey,
with them.
You know, I need something else to do, you know. So I fell into an editor that was, my closest friend. We call each other brother, and at the same time, he won't charge me for it. You know,
that's even
editing,
better.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I want to pay him so badly for his time. Like on the book, he put in hundreds of hours to get it correct, and on the second book, he has had a quintuple bypass surgery, and I had to stop him, you know, stop sending chapters to him, and after about a couple of weeks, he said, Harvey, you can start sending me the rest of the book, and I'll take care of it. And I said, I'll send you one chapter at a time, and I'll check with you and your wife to find out if it's a good time to send you another chapter, because I don't want him pushing it.
No, I know, I understand that, but it probably is what keeps him going, because he wants to do it. I know my editor for my new book got sick. And I was on Facebook, the publisher that she works for, besides doing freelance, said that the person was ill. So I emailed her and I said, just understand that when you get better, this book is going to wait for you. And I didn't have the heart, even though it took a while, to take the book away from her. And it had nothing to do with the fact that I paid her, and she doesn't charge a lot of money. It didn't cost me that much money. But the fact that she did my book and my magazine, I couldn't in due conscience say, okay, I'm going to get somebody else because you're sick. So I have to agree with that. And besides the fact that she does a really good job, and if I find mistakes or whatever, she'll go through the book as many times as I ask her to. Most editors, even when you pay them a lot of money, and it can cost you thousands to get a book edited, but the most important thing that people should know, that my listeners should know, is that you need to definitely get your book edited the right way.
Well,
and you need to definitely make sure. I mean, I'm reading an unedited version of a New York Times bestselling author and an award-winning author. I won't say who they are, but I have found quite a number of typos in all of their books. Now, the unedited version, you know, the advanced reader's copy is one thing. But the other one that I'm reading is a final copy, and I have to tell you, I read a couple of sentences over several times, and I'm saying, oh, my God, there were so many mistakes, and this is a well-known author. Actually, at one point last year, before the book came, this other author's book came out, I even emailed the publisher and said, I bookmarked several of these things. I copied the sentences and the pages. You need to fix this because they're like 10 pages with typos, and he's a New York Times bestselling author. I was the only one that caught it. I also caught some in some cases where pages and paragraphs were repeated. When I review a book, I mean, I never, ever, ever, ever in my review would ever say that anybody, you know, should, you know, definitely, you know, have a problem. You know, or that, you know, anybody, I never, ever, ever pan a book or say that a person has typos, ever, ever.
Oh, would you ever say it?
I would never say it. I would just say, I would tell, I might tell, if it's a lot, I might tell the publicist, but other than that, I never say anything. I review the book basically on content and story format. If I feel the book is not good or does not deserve 3.5 stars, I won't review it. And I won't toss it. What I'll do is I'll tell the author that I will whatchamacallit. If I would tell the author, I will so do a summary of your book, and I will not whatchamacallit review the book. If the person insists that they want me to, you know, post it, then I'll say, understand that it's just, you know, that's just the way it is, and I'm going to give you 3 stars or 3.5 or maybe 2. Usually what I do is I post it on Goodreads and Selfari, but I won't post it with a rating, and I won't post it on Amazon because it's not my job to pan a book. If I feel that a book is not meet my criteria for 4 or 5 stars, someone else might read it and might like it, and I don't want to do that to the author, and I won't do that to the author. So we have about eight more minutes. And can you give us a little bit about the next one? Can you give us a little bit of a hint?
A little bit of a hint would be that a story that seems like it's not going to go anywhere from there does go from there, and it goes in a fashion that is unexpected.
That's good.
I mean, I know I'm not saying much by doing it. Saying that I should be a politician, which I have to say, I did come down with multiple sclerosis, and 15% of the proceeds from the book go to the MS Society for research only.
Oh, that's nice. That's nice.
And, you know, we couldn't give a lot more to it than that because my partner was just starting out from college and he had to make something. So I couldn't let him give away all his money. I'm not saying that I've given everything, you know, everything of my 50%, or as he stated, I should make more. He wanted me to take 70% and him 30%. And I said, no, we're doing this together. We're a team. So I'll just take 51%, you take 49%. And from there, we'll give to my favorite charity. And if I can throw one thing in there, aside from that, would that be okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead. Tell them where the charity is. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's just the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, right now also the charity is in the name of the book, and I'm doing something else here in Chicago. A doctor of mine came up with an idea. He's a rehabilitation doctor. And so he has to work with you know, how the mind and nerves work. So came up with an idea that there is no hospital in the United States that is a brain research and study hospital in the whole country. So he is mostly, and I am trying to help. I'm looking for a known person that will be willing to put down the first large donation for it, so we can have, we have many doctors and researchers and the architect and an architect for it. We have the property, and we're just looking for money so we can finish it off and open the doors, because so many diseases have to do with the brain. And this,
I know that this,
if this works, we have a lot of the politicians, the mayor, a senator, the Speaker of the House in Illinois, they've all signed on to it. But if we can get this done, this could end up being the most important hospital in the country, because how many people does everyone know that, or they themselves, have a disease that has to do with the brain?
What I need you to do, seriously, and the producer of my show was just listening, we want you to send me the information and the link, and we're going to put it out there for you.
Okay, well, there is no official thing yet.
Okay.
The doctor has been out of the, he's a world-renowned rehab doctor. He's been out of the country quite a bit and doing work with patients when he's here, so we don't have anything. But I will tell him that you want to put it out. And,
I want to put it out there, and we want to help you get it there. And you never know, because I have a large presence on Facebook and a whole bunch of social media, and you just never, ever, ever know. I mean, my mom had Alzheimer's, and she died of Alzheimer's, so I do know. And I watched her dwindle away for a million years, and that's why I wrote the book. And the money from the proceeds from the book goes to the Ruth Sword Love Research Fund to find the cause of Alzheimer's, from Montefiore Einstein Hospital in New York in the Bronx, created this research fund in memory of my mom. And whenever we can, we give money to it. And this is so important. It's more important than anything in the world, that brain diseases, if they could find the cause or the cure for multiple sclerosis and muscular dystrophy and Alzheimer's, wouldn't it be nice if you didn't lose your mind? I mean, I know. My mother said to me one day, I can't remember like I used to, and I think I'm fading away and my mind seems to be going. And when you read my book, or anybody reads my book, it's going to be her words, her journal.
Mm-hmm.
That's the point. And my cousin read it. She's the only person that read it. I gave her permission to read it. Plus the people that were kind enough to give me blurbs for the front cover. She's the only family member that read it and called me and said, after she finished crying, she said, I did a good job. But this has been interesting, and you have to make sure, you have to promise me you're going to send me the new one when it's done.
I think I'll be able to do that. And
that would be nice, yeah.
At the same time, I don't think we are friends on Facebook, and
don't friend
I
me.
Think we'll have to do that.
Yes, friend
I
me, and you'll see all the mischief that I get into. I only post my reviews.
I'm not going to ask about that.
I only post my reviews, and I only post, my radio show. And then,
okay.
You know, if somebody has a birthday, I might say happy birthday. Or if my little niece or nephew do something wonderful in school, I might say something. Otherwise, I don't say very much on Facebook. But this is important. This is something that a lot of people, I'm sure, are going to want to, you know, hop onto. I can't imagine why they wouldn't, because it's too important. And brain diseases, whatever, is important too. So maybe one of these days you'll want to write, included in your endeavor to put this hospital out, maybe you need to write a caregiver's guide so people understand how to deal with the disease, which is what I did for my mom.
Well, there will be something available in the future.
Yeah.
Right now we're trying to get it, because to build the hospital, as everyone knows, takes a lot of money. But to start with, we're talking $500 million.
Well, maybe there are people that are at the hospital that have, you know, donors. Like, you know, you ever watch the Celebrity Apprentice and how they get their friends to donate money when it's for charities? You just never know. I mean, fundraisers are great also to raise money for something like that. Also, I'm sure through the hospital, once you get it started, they might actually, you know, do something like that. Or even if you call multiple sclerosis, maybe there are people there that run their fundraising that could help you. to do this also because it would benefit their patients,
the
organization itself. But I want to thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And please friend me on Facebook and keep in touch and let me know what's happening with this hospital. And as soon as you have the information, I will put it out. And so will Marcia, who's the producer of World of Ink, the network, and she will put it out, and we will put it everywhere so that people know. And that if there is a way that you can contact Multiple Sclerosis or any organization that deals with it, because it's in every hospital, too. You just never know. There are caregiver centers like there are in Einstein and Montefiore. You never know where you're going to get your help from.
That's true.
So thank you so
very
much.
And a friend of mine was the head of, immunological diseases at that hospital.
That's what I'm saying.
Montefiore.
In Einstein? In Montefiore?
Yes.
Well, the doctor that I work with when I wrote My Sharpest Attack with Scrambled Eggs, which describes your brain, was a famous neurologist, Joe Verghese. And Joe works with Alzheimer's patients before, you know, when they first get dementia, early onset, and aging. He works for the Home for the Aging. He's really good. And my neurologist also helped me write the book because he helped me understand, you know, a lot about Alzheimer's, which I understand too much about. And as you watch a person, it's like taking a candle and watching the wax go out slowly. And when it finally goes out, there's nothing left. And
my father had it, so
yeah.
I understand well.
Yeah, and my mom had surgery in 2003. Had they not lost her on the table in the overdose of anesthesia, they said they weren't sure that she would have had Alzheimer's or anything. They said it was because of that operation. But on that note, if somebody would make it stop snowing, I would be ever so happy. And everyone have a great day, and maybe the sun will shine. And thank you so much, Harvey, and have a great day. And
thank you, friend.